There are a lot of people who would argue that when Charles Darwin came along, outlined his ideas about evolution, published his now so famous work, The Origin of Species, it marks the end of faith in the sense that if you accept the idea that the world is the result of a slow process of evolution driven by natural selection, then that doesn't leave very much room for God. And certainly over time, people have attacked the notion of evolution because they believe so strongly in the idea of God and the idea that there was a thoughtful, purposeful creator behind the design of all living things. In this part of Focus 580, we will be talking with a guest who looks at this a little bit differently. His name is Michael Roos. He's professor of philosophy at Florida State University and is particularly interested in the philosophy of biology, especially in Darwinism, and has written a lot about this. In fact, his most recent book is titled Darwin and Design, Does Evolution Have a Purpose? It's published by the Harvard University Press. And in particular, our eye was caught by an article that he wrote that appeared recently in a magazine called Science and Spirit. This was in the November-December 2003 issue, in which he looks at how it is that people have reacted to the ideas of Darwin over time. And he comes to an interesting conclusion that despite the fact that in this country and elsewhere, there are a lot of people who identify themselves as believers in God, there's also a widespread acceptance of the notion of evolution, particularly when it applies to culture, the kind of thinking that has sometimes been labeled social Darwinism. We'll talk about some of these ideas here this morning on Focus 580, and of course, welcome comments, and I'm sure we will get them. All we ask of people who want to call in is that they're brief, just so that we can keep moving along and get in as many different people as possible. But, of course, anyone's listening is welcome to call. Here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. Also, we do have a toll-free line, 800-222-9455. If you're listening around Champaign-Urbana and you're listening over the air, of course, you can use that number. Anybody in the United States, if you were listening on the Internet, could use that number, too. That's 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Professor Roos, hello. Professor Roos? Well, I think maybe we're having a little bit of a technical problem, and I'm not quite sure what it is. We'll take a look at all of our buttons and switches and see if everything's lined up here and see if we can figure out what the problem is. As apparently the guest is there, and I can see Henry Frayne, our control room guy, talking with him on the telephone. So apparently that's not a problem. The problem is somewhere else. Well, let me take a minute here, and I'll tell you about what we'll be doing in the second hour of the show. In the second part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about the idea that's now being kicked around here by local officials in Champaign and Urbana, and also at the University of Illinois. The idea that maybe the cities and the university might want to get involved in distributing electric power. And we'll have two guests for the show. We'll be talking with the city attorney for the city of Urbana. His name is Steve Holtz. And then we'll talk with Philip Doc Mueller. He's manager of government relations and communications with the Illinois Municipal Electric Agency. So we'll talk about this idea of why it is that cities might want to get into the power business, what's involved. And then at least Mr. Holtz can talk a little bit about how local officials are thinking about that. Obviously, he can't speak for everybody, but at least as far as people are concerned in the city of Urbana. So we'll be doing that in hour number two. Now we will try again, see if we can talk with our guest, Michael Roos. Professor Roos?
Yes.
Oh, good. Thanks. I'm glad you're there.
Yes, indeed.
Let me ask you a question first. I'm curious about how it is that you, as a philosopher, someone who does philosophy, is interested in biology, particularly Darwinism.
Well, first of all, let me, before I even get to that, let me thank you for the wonderful introduction that you gave me and the wonderful spread about you gave about my book and my works. In fact, what I'd really like your listeners to do is just go out and buy lots of copies of my books, and then we can have a good talk about it. Why did I get interested in these things? Well, it's a long story in a way. Obviously, as you can tell from my accent, I was born in England, and this was in the 40s and 50s. And in fact, I did very little, virtually no biology at all when I was a student, and I like to joke about these things, that when I was a kid, the really bright kids used to do Latin and Greek, and then the middle kids would do math, physics, chemistry, and German. That was me. And then what we call the late developers used to do woodwork, geography, Spanish, and biology. So I'd never really done any biology until, in fact, I was looking for a PhD thesis topic, and my would-be supervisor, knowing I was interested in religion and these sorts of things, said, well, why don't you have a look at evolution? You know, that seems to sort of, as it were, touch on these things. And it was sort of love at first bite or love at first gene, and I've been doing it ever since.
Well, I'd like to talk about a little bit of the historical context for Darwin, and also for how people reacted to his ideas, at least in the immediate period after when Origin of Species came out. And
right.
One important point I think that you make in this article that I think is interesting is that as much as one might lay the death of God at the door of Charles Darwin, in fact, people already were questioning the notion of God. They were questioning the notion that that there was a purposeful creator behind life. And Charles Darwin wasn't the first one to talk about that. And so it may be going a bit far to say that somehow he is responsible for an attack on faith or the decline in faith.
I think that's absolutely true. I mean, there's no question that by the middle of the 19th century, a great many people, particularly in Europe, and particularly in the American North, the northern states, were, really starting to wonder whether or not the traditional faith of their fathers, the traditional religion, was something which was really working, and people were looking for alternatives. I mean, before that, I mean, we know that people, for instance, like Thomas Jefferson, for instance, were very iffy about traditional Christianity. And so people were certainly already, before Darwin, looking for alternatives, looking for ways that they could move forward. Not that they would be so much irreligious, but looking, if you like, for a kind of a new focus on things like that. A great many people were becoming what Thomas Henry Huxley was to label agnostic. That meant that they felt that they could no longer subscribe to traditional religious beliefs, but they didn't feel that they wanted to throw everything out. They certainly didn't want to just become, you know, totally immoral amoralists or anything like that. So they were looking for alternatives, and I think that Darwinism and Darwin's ideas of the origin of species you mentioned were, as it were, part cause and part effect of this. On the one hand, I think that Darwin himself, who'd certainly grown up as a traditional Christian thinker, he was what you would call an Episcopalian, and intended for the priesthood, in fact. And then his faith started not to go, but more to sort of evolve to a kind of God as unmoved mover, kind of like a Unitarian or something like that. So I think that this was part of Darwin's preparation for becoming an evolutionist. But at the same time, I think that when evolution came along and gave people, as it were, an alternative picture of origins and these sorts of things, they grasped it and incorporated it into their, what I would call their kind of new secular religion. I mean, if you want to call it secular humanism, I suppose you can, but of course that was not a term that anybody used then.
Well, this is an interesting idea that you propose, that in fact, rather than looking at Darwin and his ideas, the ideas of evolution, as being an attack on faith, on religion, on God, you suggest that people might indeed have looked at it as a way of saving all of those things.
Yes. I mean, I think one's got to be careful about these things. I mean, there were certainly Christians who took up Darwin without any trouble whatsoever, I mean, and who incorporated it into their beliefs. I mean, people like Asa Gray in America, for instance, and Charles Kingsley, the author of The Water Babies in England. So there were certainly, you know, Christians practicing Christians, who had no trouble with taking up Darwin. Now, John Henry Newman, the great Catholic convert in England, was another. So there were certainly people like that. But on the other hand, I think that there were a great many people who had already started to, had started to move beyond any kind of orthodox Christian faith. but who were looking, who didn't want to, as I say, just throw the whole thing up and say that that's all nonsense and we're moving on, but were looking now for a kind of alternative picture. And I think that it's quite clear that Darwinism, which they saw as progressive up to humankind, was something which fit in very nicely with the kind of picture they were trying to build. Mm.
Well, I wonder if we might just leap from there to the point that we are now, and let me ask you this question, because I think that there are some people who argue, and these will be people who do believe in God, do believe in creationism, perhaps, would put that forth that idea. They do make this argument that evolutionary thinking is indeed, if you look at its structure and how it functions, a kind of secular religion. And for that reason, then they make the argument that if you're going to teach evolution, then you must also teach creationism in the public school context. That's part of that argument that we're having here in this country about,
right,
about what you wanted to teach in school. And I wonder, as someone who's thought a lot about this, as someone who comes at this from a background to philosophy, what you think about that argument that says that scientists, people who embrace the idea of evolution, who basically they might have some quibbles about small points, but the overall point, accept the ideas of Darwin. Is that a kind of secular religion?
Well, I think you've got to be very careful here. I think it certainly can be. Let me say that if it were a question of introducing something like creationism or these other things into some kind of course on contemporary affairs or something like that, I would have no trouble with this, and my suspicion is that there'd be no constitutional problem with something like that. I mean, obviously, you know, schools are allowed to talk about Islam, for instance. It's a question of whether or not one's allowed to teach it as the truth. So, as I say, at that level, I've got no problem with anything like that. What worries me is when you get to, say, science classes, where religion starts to intrude. And quite frankly, I mean, I personally would be very worried. You mentioned creationism or intelligent design. I would be very worried about that being taught in biology classes. But at the same time, I'd be equally worried about, let us say, some of the writings of Richard Dawkins or even Stephen Jay Gould being presented in biology classes as part of biology. I mean, it seems to me that these are comment, if you like, of a quasi-religious nature, certainly around scientific beliefs. If people want to hold these, I think that's fine. You want to talk about it in current affairs, I think that's wonderful. I mean, I encourage it, but it's a different thing to be teaching these sorts of things in science classrooms. So my feeling is source for the creationist goose should also be source for the creationist or the the secular humanist evolutionist.
Our guest is Michael Roos. He's professor of philosophy at Florida State University in Tallahassee. He's particularly interested in philosophy of biology, especially in Darwinism, and also the history and philosophy of science. He's written quite a bit about Darwin and about evolutionary thinking. His most recent book is titled Darwin and Design, Does Evolution Have a Purpose? It's published by the Harvard University Press. And it looks at how it is that over time people have thought about this notion of intelligent design, the argument from design as is often made as a support for there being a creator. People would say, well, look at the world. Look at how complicated it is. Look at how elegant and beautiful beautifully everything fits together. That couldn't possibly have happened by accident. Someone, some thinking being had to be behind that. That's what the book Darwin and Design explores. And questions, comments are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We do have a caller to bring into the conversation in Champaign on our line number one. Hello.
Hi. I was wondering if your guests might talk a little bit about the idea of evolution in Greek philosophy and how that may have caused some of the, perhaps wouldn't call them similar, kinds of debates, but debates either in Islam, like with Averroes and other Islamic philosophers, or with Aquinas, and then, you know, the development of Western science. And since he did talk about science classes, maybe he could define, you know, what science is. And I guess I'm interested in the topic that David brought up about this movement against kind of a 19th century notion of reason and progress and science and you know, the people who are against secular humanism, it seems that there are a lot of people that feel that somehow spirit has been left out of education. I was just reading about a Buddhist movement called Buddhist Response to Global Development, and it seems to be quite left-wing, but they talk about a spirit of education movement. But perhaps one, I guess, how can one talk about science, if that's anything hard and clear to define, and then about philosophy or religion, and still not gut science?
Well, you know, terrific question, or I would be inclined to say about terrific five different questions that you're throwing at me there. Let me just try to sort of tease some of these bits and pieces apart. Certainly, the idea of evolution, I mean, you're asking me about, you know, purely factual issues. The idea of evolution is, I would say, probably an 18th century idea, but there are what one might call proto-evolutionary ideas, which certainly go back to the ancient Greeks. I mean, for instance, there was a chap called Empedocles who thought that there were various bits and pieces of body which were sort of floating around, and then they kind of came together, and some didn't function, you know, two arms, two eyes, you know, four legs and no mouth, and then others came together in the right way, and so on and so forth. So certainly people have been toying with all of these sorts of ideas for a long time. I mean, and if, when you come into the Christian era, if you think about somebody like St. Augustine, about 400 AD, he believed that God was outside time, so that when God created the earth, I mean, the idea of creation and the actual coming into being and the completed act of creation for God were as one, because God doesn't think temporally. So St. Augustine certainly thought that creation involved a kind of seeds which would then unfurl here on earth. I mean, I wouldn't call him an evolutionist as such, but he had a kind of theology or philosophy, I think, which fit in to all of those sorts of things. So, I mean, the idea of evolution is a very old idea. I mean, the contemporary idea, and of course the thing that we're talking about, is very much more something of the 19th century, people like Charles Darwin, and then coming into the 20th century. We, of course, don't forget this was the time when, you know, the great American scientists have been much involved, people like Theodosius Dobzhansky in the first half of the 20th century, and people like Edward O. Wilson at Harvard in the second half. So, I mean, there are all of these sorts of things going on. So that's to answer your, what shall I say, your factual question. But let's pick up now on your second question about spirit and these sorts of things, which I think, in a way, I suspect both you and I would think is probably the more important. I mean, I don't think any educator, and I think of myself as being one, would want to teach which didn't at some level involve spirit or some kind of moral understanding. I mean, any teacher who says, all I'm going to do is just give you the facts, I don't care about the moral development of my students, I think is a lousy teacher and a liar anyway. I mean, you know, you can't do it and you shouldn't do it. I mean, I feel very strongly about that. So I think at one level, no teacher would ever want to deny the importance of spirit at that sort of level that we're talking about there. Any good teacher, of course they want to do that. The issue, I think, that we face, and particularly in America, given the Constitution, is to what extent one could go further and introduce religious ideas. And, of course, as you know, the Constitution separates these out. Now, as I've said before, and I'll say it again, I personally am 100% in favor of comparative religion classes or these sorts of things. I think in this day and age, if an American school child doesn't learn something, let us say, about Islam, then the school isn't doing the proper job. I mean, my God, I mean, these are the problems we've been wrestling with since 9/11. I mean, not that, you know, that Islam is responsible for 9/11, but that we've got to understand the background and the whole Iraq thing and everything like that. So at that level, I think that you and I would probably be agreeing 100%.
Yes.
What we're worrying about is going that one step further, which I think is not only constitutionally forbidden, but I would want to say is educationally or pedagogically a mistake, namely to start presenting these religious ideas as factual and things, put it bluntly, things that kids are going to get a test on, be tested on and get an A or an F on and that sort of thing.
Right, and just what spirit is. Well, just what spirit is one going to teach?
Well, I mean, as I said, I mean, what spirit is one going to do? I mean, my personal feeling is a teacher tries to give students the things that they know and cherish themselves, plus, and I think this is the most important thing, the tools to go beyond the teacher. Any teacher who hopes that their students will only be as good as they are is a lousy teacher. The really good teacher, and sometimes it's tough to be this, hopes that their students will go on beyond them. So I've always said that the spirit that one tries to give to one's students is a firm moral understanding, but also a willingness to look at the things that I hold or we hold sacred and to try to move beyond these sorts of issues. And that's you know, that I think is what education is all about.
I appreciate the comments of the caller, and we have some other people here I want to get on to. I wonder just for a moment if we might consider one other question. I might raise one other question, because you have written in this article, and we've talked a little bit about the fact that after Darwin, when Darwin was sort of new, and after The Origin of Species came out, certainly there were people who objected. And there were people of strong faith who took issue with it on those grounds. But it was also the case that a lot of other people fairly easily came to accept what Darwin was saying, and that there were people who considered themselves believers who didn't seem to have any difficulty with believing both in God and believing in evolution.
Well, this is, of course, the point. And they were both Catholic and Protestant. I mean, James McCosh, the Presbyterian who was head of Princeton University, was an ardent evolutionist. And I've already mentioned Cardinal Newman, John Henry Newman, the great theologian in England, who started life as an Anglican and then moved over to Catholicism and, as I say, ended as a cardinal. And I always feel that Newman, whose religious commitment and belief in the importance of Jesus Christ. I mean, you couldn't find a more Orthodox Christian if you tried. I mean, not Greek Orthodox, but Orthodox in the sense of a Catholic believer. And yet Newman said, he said, if God wants to create through evolution, who am I to say otherwise? I mean, that's God's business. It's my, that's not where religion is at. Religion is with, my soul or your soul, with my obligations here on earth, with Jesus dying on the cross for my sins. This is what Christianity is about, not about origins, whether we were created on the sixth day or whether we came from the slime. That's irrelevant. And so, as I say, there were a great many Christians who felt that way. Now, having said that, I mean, of course, there were other equally ardent Christians who felt strongly that evolution was, the work of the devil, and felt, from that day to this, that this is a position that they want to reject. Well, at one level, what can I say but I think that they're wrong? But, of course, another part of what I am trying to say is that it takes two to tango and it takes two to quarrel, and I don't think there's been any doubt but that evolutionists themselves have often trailed their coats, and, as it were, they've been, responsible for half the battle. I mean, today, read anything written by Richard Dawkins, including his most recent book, The Devil's Chaplain, and you'll see a more ardent atheist in the name of Darwin to the extent I think that Darwin himself would have been uncomfortable, it would be hard to find the Richard Dawkins, except possibly Dan Dennett, the philosopher at Tufts University.
We have some callers here to take, and let's go on. Maybe I guess just real quick, I should introduce again our guest. We're talking this morning with Michael Roos. He's professor of philosophy at Florida State University, Tallahassee. And as I have said, he's particularly interested in philosophy, biology, especially in Darwinism. And he's written quite a bit on this, and his most recent book is titled Darwin and Design, Does Evolution Have a Purpose? And the publisher is the Harvard University Press. We have a lot of callers. In fact, the lines are full. So again, people can help us by trying to be brief and giving some space to other people who are listening. We'll go next to Bloomington, Indiana, line number 4. Hello.
I think one of the problems that you might have is people think that the origin of life challenges belief of God. The evidence for origin of life challenges a belief of God. It doesn't. Not if you examine the evidence. Even if you examine the evidence given by the most orthodox Darwinists. For instance, Richard Dawkins. You know who he is. Richard Dawkins is probably the most militant Darwin is alive today, he writes a book about evolution called, he calls his book Climbing Mount Improbable. And he admits that evolution must involve huge improbabilities. Sir Fred Hoyle, another Englishman, who calculated the probability of life arising by chance, he put a team of mathematicians together, and they calculated that probability, that they came out with the answer, one chance in 10 to the 40,000th power. That's one chance in one with 40,000 zeros after it. And Francis Crick, Nobel Prize winner for describing the structure of DNA. Let me say that the chief mathematician for Fred Hoyle's mathematics, the people who calculated that one chance in 10 to the 40,000, a mathematician by the name of Chandra Wickramasinghe. And he made a statement after he'd done this calculation. He says, the creationists say that life was created by a miracle. He says, if life occurred by chance, it's equally a miracle. He says it's tantamount to a miracle. In other words, when you're dealing with this kind of improbability, if life happens, it's a miracle. Francis Crick, Nobel Prize winner, for describing the DNA molecule, he says if life occurred by accident, it would be almost a miracle. He says because we know that the precision complexity within even the simplest living cell goes beyond any machine that human beings have ever made or ever dreamed of making. That, we're talking about the greatest, the most complex mainframe computer. Mainframe computers usually don't occur by accident. So if life occurred by accident...
Right. Well, look, can I get in on this?
Yes, and
respond to you on this. And look, at one level, I don't want to disagree. I mean, I think life is a miracle. I mean, I think there are lots of miracles. I think the fact that my wife fell in love with me, that meeting my wife and her falling in love with me, I really truly think it was something totally miraculous. But of course, it doesn't follow that this was something which necessarily went against the laws of nature. So at one level, I'm more than happy to speak of life as being a miracle or something like that.
But I think, of course,
what you're doing is sliding from that sense of miracle, something that is just truly wonderful, to something which breaks the laws of nature, something which requires some intervention outside the laws of nature. And then, of course, I start to get a lot more worried about this, and particularly when you start to give me these calculations, because they sound to me so much like the engineer's way of coming up with a solution. You know, you think of a number, double it, and the answer you want is half of that number. And my trouble is people seem to pick these figures out of thin air, and then they blow them up. Of course, if things are just chance, then it is going to be a miracle. It's not going to happen. But, of course, the thing is, as certainly Francis Crick knows only too well, what we've got are processes like natural selection, which very rapidly start to, you know, to cut down on the choices. And then, of course, the thing... that level is no longer anything like as miraculous. And we know now about mutation, we know now about all of these things. And as I say, then the thing starts to get a lot less miraculous. But what worries me at a deeper level is that this whole insistence on miracle and that sort of thing seems to me at a certain level to be deeply anti-Christian, because it's implying that God couldn't do it through law. And that strikes me as heretical.
May I say, sir, am I still
yes, go ahead.
That I was talking about miracles, huge improbabilities. These are not my figures.
They're not my figures either. But as I say, you know and I know, you've got one side's going to give you one set of figures, and the other side is going to give you another set of figures. And, you know, as the English Prime Minister, Benjamin Disraeli, once said, he said there are three kinds of untruth: lies, damn lies, and statistics. And I start to feel a little that way about those sorts of figures.
Well, let's turn to another type of evidence. Let's turn to the fossil record.
Listen, the trouble is, I don't think you and I are really engaging in argument. All you're trying to do is trot out the creationist arguments and knock me down. I just don't think you're interested in engaging in debate.
We're dealing with evidence here.
Yes, right.
When Stephen Jay Gould says that modern cellular animals make their first uncontested appearance in the fossil record some 570 million years ago, and with a bang, not with protracted crescendo. In other words, it occurs suddenly, all of a sudden.
He's wrong. Have you read Simon Conway Morris's most recent book, On Life Solution, where Conway Morris goes after Stephen Jay Gould's wonderful life, line by line, and shows that that's just not wrong. Now, the trouble is, then you say, you've got evidence, and I say, now we've got more evidence, which shows that Gould was wrong to say these things. Are you now going to concede and say, sorry, whoops, I made a mistake, I think evolution's right?
I'm going to jump in, and I hope the caller will forgive me. I'm sure he'd like to continue the conversation, but as I said, the lines are full. We have others, and I know that he and you are not going to come to a meeting of the mind, so we'll go on. Muhammad is next here, one of our local neighboring communities. Line two. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Actually, your guest just talked about what I was going to ask about. I'm from the other side of the spectrum of your previous caller, but you mentioned Jay Gould, and now you're who I usually take most of my biology from. Punctuated equilibrium, and you think that theory is now, like, refuted by the evidence, is that right?
Well, the trouble with punctuated equilibrium, and for the benefit of other listeners, this is the idea that evolution goes in jumps rather than just gradually. It's one of those sorts of ideas which is both true and not true. I mean, sure, nobody's going to deny that at certain points in time, you know, certain evolutionary events occurred really very, very quickly indeed. They certainly didn't occur in just one generation. And of course, Gould, you know, by the denied to the day of his death that that's what he ever claimed.
Right.
So,
right.
As I say, I don't think, I mean, you know, I mean, it's one of those, I mean, it really is a genuine issue of probabilities. Does one look at the history of life and see that it's more jumpy than gradual? Or does one see that it's more gradual than jumpy? I don't think anybody denies that sometimes it's gradual, sometimes it's jumpy. The question is, which is the tendency?
Okay, well, thank you.
All right, let's go to line number one, the next caller, Urbana. Hello. There a caller there on line number one? Okay, how about let's go to line number three in Urbana. Well, now we've got three lines all on the same time. Hold on a second. Maybe we better clear a couple of those off. Let me real quick mention again our guest this morning in this part of Focus 580, Michael Roos. He's professor of philosophy at Florida State University. That's in Tallahassee, and has done a lot of thinking about and writing about biology, and also about Darwin and Darwinism. His most recent book is titled Darwin and Design, Does Evolution Have a Purpose? Well, now we'll go here to line number three in Urbana. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Hi. I teach a class at the university on the existence of God, and we talk a lot about intelligent design. And one of the things when we talk about that, of course, it brings up the question of evolution. And one of the things I really focus on with my students is the idea that there are two different ideas at work there. You have the ideas of someone like Richard Dawkins, who would have what we might call a grand evolutionary theory that involves things like common ancestry and natural selection, but then also this idea of naturalistic origins. And I think it's important to distinguish between the kind of grand evolutionary theory and another kind of theory of evolution that would not necessarily assume naturalistic origins. And I just wanted to know, you've sort of talked a little bit about this, and I wanted to know if you could say more about that, and I'll just hang up and listen. Thank you very much.
All right.
Okay, good, I think, important issues. One can draw what has been called a distinction between methodological naturalism and metaphysical naturalism. And, those are sort of highfalutin terms for something much more simple. I mean, I think the thing is, as a scientist, one makes a commitment to atheism, as you like, in the sense that one says, I'm going to go into the lab and God is not going to come in with me. In other words, what one is going to do is one is going to try to explore the mysteries, the miracle, if you like, of the living world, if one's a biologist, without reference to God. One is going to keep pushing to try to explain things through unbroken law and so on and so forth. And frankly, I would want to say that scientists, and not just biologists, have been pretty successful at doing this. But of course, that is not to say that one necessarily, as it were, in one hearts of hearts, is an atheist in the sense that one necessarily believes that there is no God. It's just the working assumption one is going to make as a scientist. And so metaphysically, one might well want to say, of course, I put all of this in the broader context of it might be one's Christian beliefs or one's Islam or Buddhist beliefs or something like that. I want to say, but of course, this world of ours is a world which was created by God and so on and so forth. But that, as I say, I think is a different issue, and I'm sure that your caller, I'm sorry he's rung up because I think we might have a few things to talk about, but certainly I'm sure that these are the sorts of things that your caller is dealing with when he's teaching and when he's discussing in class, and one trying to help the students to sort of tease out, if you like, these different levels at which we're thinking and which we're working.
We are coming up to about our last 10-15 minutes on the program here. Something we need to do here just for a moment, though, we're going to pause, something we're required to do at this time once a month, always on the first Tuesday. We'll do this. This is a test of the emergency alert system. And you are listening to AM 580 WILL Urbana. This is Focus 580, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. And once again, here we're talking this morning with Michael Roos. He's professor of philosophy at Florida State University at Tallahassee. We'll go on here. We'll get another caller in. We'll go next to Lovington, and that's line number 4. Hello.
Hi. I just a couple of days ago finished reading a book by Rodney Stark called For the Glory of God. Are you familiar with his work?
No, I can't honestly say I am, but go on.
That was my main question. He says that the rise of science was something that happened only in Europe and because of the influence of the church.
Well, of course, this is a well-known thesis. I mean, it goes back to Merton and others like that. And more than just the church. I mean, Merton argued that that the rise of modern science and Protestantism are much connected. I think that most scholars today would want to go back a lot further than that, and they would want to point out that the Catholic Church, particularly in the medieval period, had a great deal to do with that. I mean, I think, you know, there are other scholars, and I suspect I'd be not unsympathetic to this, who would want to say this is all a little Eurocentric, and to say that science only rose in the West is surely not entirely true, that certainly the Chinese and the Indians had great knowledge of mathematics and certainly technological understandings well before the West rose up in quite the way that it did. But certainly if you're talking in the context of the West, I don't think any scholar today would want to deny that the church was incredibly influential, and certainly in the case of Darwin, and if you look at my book, this is a point that I'm making, and I'm not in any sense claiming to be original on this point, that Darwin himself was deeply influenced by the Christian ideas. In fact, I would want to say that the whole quest for evolution is in a sense a Judeo-Christian question, because it's a question about origins. Where did we come from? Where are we? Where are we going? I mean, these are not the sorts of questions, and we go back to our first caller, these are just not the sorts of questions that basically the ancient Greeks asked about. They saw the earth as being eternal and just, you know, going on with its constant motions and never really going anywhere. It isn't until you get the Judeo-Christian picture on the scene that you start to think in this historical historical way. And, of course, evolution is offering a somewhat different answer, at least to the, you know, the Bible taken absolutely literally. But it's offering an answer to the Judeo-Christian question. So I would want to agree entirely with you, or certainly with the person that you've been reading, that to try to deny or underestimate the importance of religious thought in our context of Christian thought for modern science is just simply wrong.
Well, I was wondering what the scholarly reaction to Stark's book was.
The scholarly reaction is, I mean, basically, yes, but so what else is new?
He spends a lot of time...
I mean, go on, I'm sorry.
Yeah, he makes a lot of very critical remarks about evolutionary theory and Darwin and Huxley and so forth. And
well...
Given your interest, you might want to take a look at it.
Yeah, well, people make a lot of critical remarks about the way I do the washing up, you know, but it's something that I've learned to live with.
All right, thank you.
Thank you for the call. Here, back here to someone else. Next, Urbana, line one. Hello.
That caller from Indiana, he keeps citing probability, but in order to come up with probability, you have to know the universe of possibility. In order to create probabilities, correct probabilities anyway. And he always refuses to see that point. But anyway, I wanted to ask you about intelligent design. I didn't quite get whether you thought...
Right. Okay, fine. Let me first of all agree with you. And I mean, my rather flip comment about, you know, think of a number, double it, and then the answer won't... you want is half, was basically the point that you were making. I mean, this playing with probabilities, you want to know where people start, and the trouble is people tend to start, you know, with a position which they know is going to generate the answer that they want, and so that's why I'm always, you know, rather dubious about these. Intelligent design, certainly for the listeners, is this so-called new theory that's being pushed by Michael Behe in his book Darwin's Black Box, and by a man called William Dembski in a number of writings, which argues that organisms show something they call irreducible complexity, which is such that it's so complex that it would be impossible for it to come through blind law, that is to say, certainly through evolution, and therefore one must at some level invoke some kind of extra scientific force to do it. I mean, they're a bit cagey about whether this is the Christian God, although most of them are, in fact, evangelical Christians. And basically, what I want to say is, first of all, you know, there's nothing very new about this. I mean, this was the position being pushed before Darwin by people like Archdeacon Paley. And secondly, I'd want to say, well, why do we need it? I mean, that I think natural selection can do the job. And thirdly, I take these points very seriously. It seems to me that the intelligent design people have got very severe theological problems of their own. If, in fact, you're going to invoke a God to create, let us say, the hand or the eye, then you start to ask, if this God is so involved in the creation, why didn't this God, as it were, prevent the very simple but absolutely horrendous, you know, those mutations which, say, lead to things like sickle cell anemia, which cause, you know, infinite suffering and death? I mean, why didn't, you know, this intelligent designer straighten a few of these things out while he or she or it was at it? So, as I say, what worries me about intelligent design is not so much that it's anti-scientific, although I think, in fact, it is, but it strikes me as being theologically so problematic for the Christian. I just wish people wouldn't go down that particular path.
Well, I tend to agree with you, like 99% compared to evangelists, for example, but... I do think that a lot of scientists don't, they're a little too ambivalent about, or their arguments aren't that great about countering intelligent design.
Well, I think I would agree with you. I mean, let me put it this way. I think if you took a, you know, representative body of evolutionists, whether it's on the FSU campus or in Illinois campus, you're going to find, you know, to a person, they're going to be pretty critical of intelligent design. There are days when I wish to God some of these people would get off their butts and go out and do a bit more fighting against intelligent design rather than just getting on with their own research. I mean, I can understand why they do this, because I do see intelligent design and these other forces as being politically very dangerous indeed, and there's no question but that these people are trying to get themselves into school science classes and all of these sorts of things, and that if they're successful, then, you know, I think that modern-day science teaching in America is in for a pretty, you know, a pretty rocky future.
Yeah, you know, somewhat parallel to this problem is recently, or, you know, over the last few years, there have been pictures of Mars, and we thought that there was we could see a face.
People have been looking at the moon and seeing faces for a long time, haven't they? You know.
Yeah, but I mean, that is kind of a similar problem here, because if in fact we did see a face on Mars, I mean, I would guess quite a few scientists would say that certainly was not a natural artifact. But I just wanted to ask you one quick last question, because I agree with you that Gould's been shot down 100 times, and particularly with the idea that if we rewound the tape of history, yep, we wouldn't get the same species. I was wondering if you'd heard about this other book, Life Solution.
Yeah, that's Simon Conway Morris that I was talking about at the beginning of the program. Let me say something, first of all, about Gould. I mean, he's dead now, so, you know, he can't answer back. I knew Steve Gould, and I consider myself privileged to have known him. I mean, I think that Steve Gould was, you know, a man of whom America can be truly proud. I think that he, you know, whatever his faults, and they were there, I think Steve worked long and hard to both with the joy of ideas and to communicate these to other people. And I think that certainly my life and the lives of a lot of other people would have been a lot less rich without Steve having existed. So, you know, I want to say that flatly. Having said that, I mean, of course, the joy about Steve is he put up ideas that you want to knock down and you want to have a good fight about. I'm not convinced that Simon Conway Morris in this new book, it's called Life Solution, is right, where he argues that, you know, once life gets going, you know, humans are pretty much bound to emerge. I'm not sure that Conway Morris is right about that. On the other hand, I think that Conway Morris certainly shows that Gould hasn't made the definitive case the other way, like Gould rather claimed, namely that, you know, what, as your caller said, you play life's tape one way and one lot of things happen, you play life's tape another way and another lot of things happen. I mean, I suspect my suspicion, like most of us, is that, you know, intelligence, consciousness were things out there waiting to be, what shall I say, invaded, discovered, or whatever it is. And so I very much doubt that Michael Ruse would appear, you know, all over the universe, although I wish my wife would. But certainly I'm inclined to think that, you know, the possibility of some kind of extraterrestrial of some sort or another is not beyond the realm of possibility anyway.
We just have a couple of minutes left. You know, there's another aspect that we haven't really talked about. Unfortunately, we don't have much time, but I'm interested in at least having you talk a couple of minutes about the idea that despite all protestations to the contrary, that here in this country and perhaps elsewhere, a lot of people do accept some basic elements of evolutionary thinking, particularly the idea that there is progress. That is,
yes,
somehow things are getting better and better or more and more elevated or whatever it is. And whether that comes to, and I suppose in a lot of sense, that really gets applied to culture more than to biology, but that people generally do accept that idea, and that is also something that comes to us from Darwin.
You know, I say cynically, you believe in progress until you've got teenage children, and then, you know, it takes a hell of a knock. No, I mean, I think that, you know, most of us do, and I mean, it's a difficult thing, isn't it? I mean, how can one believe in progress in the light of the Holocaust? I mean, if, you know, the Germans, the highest, you know, form of European civilization, and they behaved that sort of way. So at one level, you know, and I mean, this goes back to the sort of Gould-Conway-Morris debate. At one level, you say to believe in progress is in itself obscene. And yet at another level, we certainly see that there's been a huge amount of progress in the last 100, 150 years. I mean, not just technological. I mean, here am I in Tallahassee talking to you people in Illinois, but also socially. I mean, the way that, for instance, I mean, I'm in public education. I mean, I see kids able to come and be educated. I see black kids and white kids sitting together in class. So at another level, I see I see a huge amount of progress going on. So as I say, I think that this is one of those sort of dilemmas. Is there really progress in culture? Is there progress in evolution? The answer is, I think that you can. There's a good arguments one way, there's good arguments another way, and that, of course, is what keeps people like me in business and going on writing books.
Hmm. Are we continuing to evolve?
Are we continuing to evolve? Of course we are, in the sense that new mutations are being poured into the human species all the time. Of course we are, in the sense that things like AIDS are acting very strongly as a selective agent in Africa at the moment. Are we continuing to evolve in the sense of getting bigger and better brains? There's no reason to think that we are. I mean, you know, if anything, the Neanderthals had bigger brains than we have. So at that level, I don't think that we are continuing to evolve. But of course, don't forget that humans have transcended that. I mean, we are now cultural beings. And so even if our brains aren't getting bigger, our computers' brains are. So, you know, at another level, probably not, but who cares?
Well, we're going to have to leave it at that, with our thanks to our guest, Michael Roos, from the Department of Philosophy, Florida State University, Tallahassee. His most recent book, if you'd like to look at it, is titled Darwin and Design, Does Evolution Have a Purpose? And it's published by the Harvard University Press. And Professor Roos, again, thank you very much.
Thanks to your speakers, your questioners, who are a terrific group of people. Thanks a lot.
All right.